Of the seminar in which we look at the subject of responding to the challenge of riba in the world today. There are two responses possible. One we may describe as the macro response and the other as the micro response. The macro response is in the Quran. It is a response in which you eventually eradicate riba completely, totally, out of the economy. Uproot it, throw it out. And you have a riba-free economy. That response is one in which you have different stages. Stage one, public education. A mass program of public education. That is still possible for us today. Stage two, legislation prohibiting riba and enforced by the coercive authority of the state, but with no retroactive enforcement. And then stage three, after the snake has been cornered and the public relations exercise has succeeded in removing the veil so that the people can see the snake, recognize it as a snake, after the process of demonization of the snake. So you've won the public relations exercise. Stage three is the retroactive enforcement of the legislation, backed up by the coercive authority of the state. Namely, you wage war. This is the method which is given in the Quran and which was applied by the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam in Medina. This is the macro level, the macro response. It is not possible for us today to pursue a macro response to its culmination, because nowhere on the first face of the earth today is it possible for us to take control of territory in Allah's blessed name and enforce Allah's law in that territory, and in that territory recognize Allah as Al-Malik. If Iran wants to be such a territory, Iran will have to withdraw from the United Nations organization. Yes, because Articles 24 and 25 of the Charter of the UN give to the Security Council of the United Nations organization supreme authority in the world in all matters pertaining to international peace and security, which is why so many UN members are now arguing against Mr. Bush. Listen, Charter says so. Bush says, I don't care for Charter. I never did. I never did. If Iran wants to have what may be described as an Islamic state or Darul Islam, in which the territory will recognize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as Al-Malik, sovereign, one of the implications would be withdrawal from the United Nations organization. Any state which attempts to withdraw from the UN or attempts to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they make a horrible example of you, and they have the power to do it. Who are they who have this power? Does the Quran explain it? It does. In Surah Al-Kahf, where it introduces the subject of Ya'juj and Ma'juj. In Surah Al-Anbiya, where it speaks again on the subject of Ya'juj and Ma'juj, and gives a relationship between Ya'juj and Ma'juj and the return of the Jews to the Holy Land to reclaim it. And in Sahih Muslim, where the Prophet ﷺ has spoken about the power. No, sorry, it's Hadith Al-Qudsi, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has spoken about the power. We do not have it within the framework of this seminar to teach the subject of Ya'juj and Ma'juj. But I would like to recommend that you read my book, Jerusalem in the Quran. There's a whole chapter dealing with the subject of Ya'juj and Ma'juj. On the basis of which I have concluded that it is impossible for us to take control of territory anywhere on the face of the earth today to establish Islam. But that will come, that will become possible in the not too distant future, when a Muslim army liberates the Holy Land. But I've also said that if there are those who differ with me and who feel convinced that it is possible to restore control over territory in the name of Islam today, which means to restore the Khilafah, then by all means they can pursue the effort. But what are the implications of the restoration of the Khilafah? Before September the 11th, could Mullah Umar in Afghanistan have been recognized as the Khalifa. There were many who suggested that Mullah Omar should be recognized as the Khalifa, Taliban's Afghanistan. All right. So you recognize Mullah Omar as the Khalifa. And then the time of Hajj comes. So Mullah Omar sends his passport to the Saudi consulate. Could you kindly give me a visa so I can perform the Hajj? Huh? What nonsense! Could you kindly give me a visa so I can perform the Hajj? Saudi say, but you're supposed to have the ticket here. And you must supposed to have a guarantor. And you must supposed to have this and that and that. Mullah, you've not finished all the application formalities here. So Mullah goes back and he gets help to do this and to do that and to do that. He come back with all his forms. And could you kindly give me a visa to perform the Hajj? The Khalifa, eh? Your Khalifa! Asking for permission for a visa to perform the Hajj. And then the Saudi consulate says, no, sorry, we rejected your visa. Huh? Khalifa can't perform the Hajj? You can come back next year if you want, but this year, no. Is there anything Mullah Omar can do about it? No. Is he Khalifa? Can you be Khalifa? Well, you can't even perform the Hajj? The implication of being a Khalifa, whose authority as Khalifa can be legitimized, is that you must have control over the Hajj and the Haramain. No one can take control over the Hajj and Haramain unless the United States of America permits it. Because the United States of America controls the Hajj and the Haramain. In the sense that the United States of America controls the Saudi state. And the Saudi state controls the Hajj and the Haramain. Well then, if the macro response is not possible, how can we restore real money in the market? I had very fraternal relations with Taliban in New York. Dr. Mujahid Abdul Hakim was the Taliban representative in North America. And he was based in New York. A very learned man, a very cultured man, a very refined man. And he became a dear friend. I met with him several times over a period of 3 years. In fact, he used to be sending tape recordings of my lectures back to Kabul. And the leadership of Taliban used to be listening to these lectures, translated for them into the local language. And I said to the Taliban representative, please inform Taliban that this paper money is haram and they should restore sunnah money, gold and silver coins. Taliban responded to me and kept on responding to me for 3 years. To declare, sorry Imran, but our ulama in Afghanistan differ with you. Until 2 days before September the 11th. September the 11th was a Sunday, was a Tuesday. 2 days before the September the 11th attack, it was a Sunday. And I was invited for lunch by the Taliban representative in New York. And on that occasion he smiled, he says, I have good news for you. Taliban has now agreed to speak with you on the subject of money. To attempt to bring back sunnah money, gold and silver coins, to the market in Afghanistan. 2 days later, September 11 came. And Taliban is now history. I thought that that was a place where perhaps we could succeed in bringing back gold and silver as money. And that is now lost. And so nowhere on the face of the earth today is it possible, in my opinion, at the level of government, to eradicate riba. Well then, if the macro response is not possible because of lack of power, what do we do? We don't only have a problem about lack of power, we have another problem. We have an internal problem now, where we have learned institutions of Islamic learning delivering fatwas. Bank interest is not riba. It began with Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, who was Sheikh Al-Azhar, who at the end of the 19th century, I believe, went on a visit to Europe. This was a Europe whose economy was now in the embrace of riba. And this is a Europe which had now embraced the modern secular state built on the foundations of shirk. Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, having visited Europe, returned to Egypt to declare, I went to Europe and I found Islam, but I didn't find Muslims. And I've come back to Egypt where I find Muslims, but I cannot find Islam. If ever a man was totally and completely and absolutely deceived. It was Sheikh al-Azhar, because he could not recognize the riba in the modern European economy after the French Revolution. And he could not recognize the shirk at the foundations of the modern secular state. He came back to Egypt, which was under the control of Britain and only nominally independent. He came back to a British Egypt in which Britain had established the new postal system, the post office. He came back to an Egypt in which the British in the Egyptian post office were now inviting the Egyptian people to invest in the post office. And the investment would be such that it would yield a return, which would be a fixed return, and today easily recognizable as interest. Sheikh al-Azhar gave a fatwa to the effect that that was not riba. And from that day to this day, a significant part of the Egyptian ulama, particularly those, Jazakumullah khair, particularly those who are in positions of state responsibility, have continued to faithfully hold on to the line. The last being Sheikh Tantawi, who used to be Mufti of Egypt and who is now Sheikh al-Azhar. About 1 month ago, was it? They issued a fatwa declaring, for the first time, declaring plainly and clearly, bank interest is not riba. So we have an additional problem, not just the lack of power for the coercive authority of the state. We have an eminent institution of learning in India, an institution of learning for which we should have respect, and I have respect, called the Deoband Institute. And I'm not a part, and I'm not party to any people who are waging a scurrilous, uncharitable attack on that institution of learning. The Deoband Institute produced ulama who delivered fatwas on the subject of riba, which now hang like an albatross around their necks. For the last 70 years, those fatawa are there concerning modern bank interests. A similar fatwa to the one issued by al-Azhar. To compound this problem, we have a reluctance on the part of our muftis to declare bank paper money to be riba. A mufti came to visit me in Egypt, a young man who declared to me that he was an expert on the subject of riba. So I smiled, because I know I will never make a statement that I am an expert on anything. My beard is gray. He's a young man. He announced to me, I'm an expert on the subject of riba. Ask me any question you want. And he sat himself very comfortably on the sofa. May Allah guide him and protect him and increase him in his knowledge. He's a young man. We all young sometime in our lives. We all young. I wouldn't like to see a video of myself when I was young. I might be very embarrassed myself. So may Allah forgive him and guide him and protect him, that he may grow, inshallah, become mature. Ameen. I attempted to demonstrate to him that paper money was false, was haram. He didn't disagree with me in my arguments. He disagreed with me in my conclusion. He adopted a very pragmatic approach to the subject of what was halal and what was haram. A very pragmatic approach. He said to me, how can I declare that paper money is haram when I have the stuff in my pocket? Very pragmatic approach to the subject. It made me look like a fool. I don't want to look like a fool. So I can't declare that this thing is haram when I have it in my pocket. But at the more serious level, there is an extreme reluctance to declare paper money to be haram, because you now face a mountain of a problem after you declare it to be haram. What next, Mufti? If this paper money is haram, Mufti, what next? Mufti doesn't have an answer as yet, in consequence of which I would like to believe that Mufti does recognize the problem but he's not blind to it. But Mufti cannot declare it to be haram because of the implications that will arise. This is the most charitable construction I can make to the fact that we do not have a fatwa. Paper money is haram. I met with Qazi Hussein Ahmad, who is the head of the Amir of the Jamaat-Islami of Pakistan, organization founded by Maulana Abul Ala Maududi. Qazi Hussein Ahmad is a charming man, a wonderful man, a sincere Muslim, a learned man, a courageous man. And you could not feel but like him when you're in his company. He was very, very gracious to me to invite me to meet with him and to spend a long time discussing the subject. At the end of the discussion, Qazi Hussein Ahmad had the integrity to declare to me concerning paper money, "It's dhoka hai. It's dhoka hai. This is all deception. This is fraud." Qazi Hussein declares paper money to be fraudulent. "It's dhoka hai. But Imran, what can I do? We cannot move forward without fatwa. Not the Jamaat Islami. And we don't have a fatwa." That was his predicament. Although he had the capacity to recognize the paper money as haram, he was powerless to do anything about it because he did not have fatwa. And so we have a number of problems in attempting to respond to the predicament of riba. What have we done so far? We've had a response called Islamic banking. And I have no doubt at all in my heart that many of those who were involved in the effort of establishing the response of Islamic banking did so with sincerity, with faith in their hearts, making an honest effort to try to find an alternative. And so when I comment on Islamic banking, I do not do so in any malicious and vindictive and uncharitable way. No. But those who pioneered the effort are now gone. And the banker, who has a Muslim name and who has a tremendous experience in banking, that banker has now put on the suit of Islamic banking. And when you question him, he hides behind fatwa. What is Islamic banking today? Is it an authentic response? Out of 100% of all the financial activities of the Islamic bank, you probably would find maybe 6 or 8 or 10% which are halal. And about those halal transactions, we have no problem. We don't have to discuss them. But by far the overwhelming majority or percentage of the revenue which comes to Islamic banks come from a transaction which they describe as murabaha. Another is ijara. What is murabaha? A transaction which yields a profit, in which both parties to the transaction know the extent of the profit. Murabaha is a halal transaction. I buy the goods for 100 rands. You know I bought it for 100 rands. And I sell it to you for 120 rands. You know I'm making a profit of 20 rands. You agree to buy from me. It's a halal transaction. The Islamic bank declares the house... Oh wait, no, first... Umar radiallahu ta'ala, who came into the market and found a man selling his goods at less than the market price. He told the man, "Raise your price or get out of our market." So there is such a thing as market price in Islam. The norm of a business transaction in Islam is a cash transaction. Market price is cash price. For some of you present, I don't need to bother to continue with the subject. The subject is already finished now. Just these two statements. But for the others, I have to continue. From the time I've said these two things, the matter is finished. No need to continue further. The norm of a business transaction in Islam is a cash transaction. And a credit transaction is an exception to the norm. Market price is cash price in Islam. And so when Umar radiallahu ta'ala, who came to the market and found a man selling his goods at less than the market price, he's talking about a cash price. "Raise your price or get out of our market" means raise your price to the market price. which is the cash price. The market price must be respected in Islam. You don't play games with the market price. Not when Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu is around. He'll throw you out of the market. Now we can continue with Murabaha. The house is on sale for 100,000 rands. That would be a moderately priced house, eh? No? Can't buy a house for 100,000? Okay. The house is on sale. We're not talking about Rondebosch East. The house is on sale for 150,000 rands. Okay? Let me make it 200,000. The house is on sale for 200,000 rands. No, let's go back to the 100,000 because that's a nicer figure to deal with, okay? The house is on sale for 100,000 rands. That's the market price. And therefore, that's the cash price. I don't have the money to buy cash. Islamic Bank says they will buy the house for 100,000 and they will sell the house to me for 400,000. Since I know their buying price and I know their selling price, I know the extent of the profit, and since I agree to pay 400,000, Islamic Bank says that this qualifies as murabaha. Well, wait a minute, what did you say? How much? 400,000? Why would I pay 400,000 for a house when the market price is 100,000? If it is a cash transaction, then someone should make an appointment for me to see a psychiatrist. If it's a cash transaction. Okay? No, it's not a cash transaction. It's a credit transaction. The reason why I am prepared to pay 400,000 and therefore an additional, or what they call a markup, an additional 300,000, the reason why I am prepared to pay that is because the Islamic Bank is giving me 30 years in which to pay it. That is the only honest answer to the question. Why am I prepared to pay an additional 300,000 over and above the market price? All other answers are dishonest. If I'm paying an additional 300,000 in consideration of time, then that increase is money which has increased because of time. But money cannot increase over time. If you didn't plant, you cannot reap, says Allah. The bank is not planting, the Islamic Bank, but it is reaping a profit of 300,000 over time. Had this been a cash transaction, then all we would have had to do is to call the psychiatrist, that's all. But this is not a cash transaction. This is a credit transaction. And therefore this is riba. But it is not riba through the front door. It is riba through the back door. It not only does not qualify as a response to riba in the market. It actually corrupts our capacity to respond when we accept this as an authentic response. Well then, what about ijara? Leasing. If I lease something to you, it is what you call a rental agreement. Is it permissible in Islam to rent? Can I rent a house? Frankly, I don't consider myself competent to answer that question. Particularly after I read the doctoral thesis written by Dr. Ziaul Haq, the Pakistani scholar, in which he went to work on this. And he was able to demonstrate and argue that a rental agreement was haram. So I'm going to excuse myself. The majority opinion is that yes, it is permissible to rent. To the extent that we accept that majority opinion, that a rental agreement is a halal agreement, the ijara of the Islamic Bank would be halal on the condition that the rent is a market rent, because all transactions in Islam take place in the market. If the rental agreement fixes a rent arbitrarily, which is not the market rent, then you are engaged in a corruption of the market. And Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu would throw you out of the market. Unfortunately, that is precisely what happens. In nearly every instance that I have studied, the Islamic financial institutions which enter into rental arbitrarily fix the rent without allowing the market to determine the rent. When we ask them why, they say, well, we got to pay our investors, so we have to make a certain sum of money to pay them. So we decide what rent you will pay. Let us now turn to a response which I found in San Francisco. I've not found it anywhere else. The house is on sale for $100,000. I have $10,000. The Islamic financial institution comes along and they put up the other $90,000. And the house is now bought. But it is bought on the basis of a transaction which is a partnership. Musharaka. The Islamic financial institution is a partner and they own 90% of the house. And I am a junior partner and I own 10% of the house. The Prophet said, sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam, when two believers enter into a partnership, Allah becomes the third partner, and Allah will remain the third partner, so long as neither partner cheats the other. And so if you have some extra cash, and you would like to invest it, and you would like to have Allah Himself as a partner with you in the investment, then a good thing to do is to enter into musharaka, partnership. The partnership now rents the house to me at the market rental value. And I'm going to leave that there because that's a can of worms. take a little time to determine what is authentic market value. So just leave that there. The partnership now rents the house to me at the market rental value. And when I pay that rent, which is say $1,000 a month, $100 comes back to me as my return on my investment, and $900 go to them as their return on their investment. If there are any taxes to be paid, the partnership pays it. You think the bank does that? Huh? Your commercial bank does that? The partnership pays it. And so that partner will pay 90% of the taxes and I will pay 10% of the taxes. Banker must be hating me for what I'm telling you now. If there are any maintenance and repairs on the house, the partnership pays for it. And so the bank will pay 90% of the bill and I will pay 10%. That's justice, isn't it? If there is a requirement for insurance and you cannot escape from it, then the bank will pay 90% and I would pay 10%. You wish you could buy a house like that, eh? Now comes the buying of the house. The partnership will now sign a second agreement with me, which will give me the legal right to increase my equity in the house. That I can buy an additional 10%, an additional 10%, whenever I want to or periodically. So that my 10% will become 20 and 30 and 40, and his 90 will become 80 and 70 and 60, etc. But every time I want to increase my equity by buying additional shares now in the house, we will have to transact that business in the market. Meaning, we will have to determine the value of the 10% of the house, additional 10% that I want to buy, the value at the time that I want to buy it. Because the value of the house could change, could go up or go down. Usually it doesn't go down, except when drugs come around. So if the additional 10% is no longer valued as $10,000, but it is now valued at $11,000, in order for me to buy an additional 10%, I'll have to pay $11,000. When I have paid off and I have bought and I now control the total equity in the house is mine. I have never entered into riba. I have never entered into debt. And I would most likely have paid less over this transaction than I would have paid if I went and borrowed the money as a loan from the bank at commercial rates. I have found this method applied only among some lovely Muslim brothers I met in San Francisco. But in the United States and in Canada, and I guess in so many other parts of the world today, when this method is applied, the rent is arbitrarily fixed. It is not market rent. Number two, the cost of taxes is not borne by the partners on the basis of their percentage of ownership. Number three, maintenance and repairs is not shared by the partners. Number four, additional purchases of equity are not based on market value. These are the significant defects in that system. In consequence of which, many people in Malaysia complained to me. They said, we went to your Islamic bank and we ended up paying more than we'd have paid with a commercial loan from the commercial bank. There has been a response to riba, to which South Africa and Cape Town in particular should be more aware than most Muslims around the world. It has come from a movement called the Murabitun, founded by Sheikh Abdul Qadir al-Murabit. But the actual economic brains in that movement is our dear brother whom we love very much, Omar Vadilio. Let me at the beginning confess that I have read what they have written, and I have benefited from their writing. And I have immense admiration for the work which they have done, because they have certainly done more than all the rest of us. The Murabitun has recognized the heart and essence of the problem of riba, not only in the banking system, but even more spectacularly, the Murabitun, and only the Murabitun, and no one else but the Murabitun, have recognized riba in paper money. The Murabitun is one of the only organizations in the world attempting to recover sunnah money, gold and silver coins. Murabitun has even gone to the extent of minting their own dinars. They minted in Dubai. A gold dinar is 0.425 of an ounce. Correct me if I'm wrong. Of a gram. Of 4.25 grams. Okay, you're not too familiar with it. I think it is 4.25 grams of gold in one dinar. And the Murabitun has chosen this weight for a dinar because this corresponds to the dinar which was minted in the time of the Khulafa Rashidun. The Murabitun has gone one step further in attempting to establish the Muslim market, a market in which they would use the sunnah money. They did this in England, in a place called Norwich, or Norfolk, or something like that. The Murabitun have now moved in a different direction, one with which I'm not that comfortable. Electronic commerce, e-commerce, and an electronic dinar. So that You will no longer hold your money in your own pockets. Now, the gold coins are to be stored in a central storehouse. And you will be delivered with an electronic receipt for the money which is stored in the electronic storehouse. That's exactly how the attack of paper money began. Those who are launching this effort today may be sincere and may be a people who can be trusted. And that is precisely the way it may have started with paper money, with the Bank of England. But at the end of the day, Shaitan took over. And the receipt had no value. It could not be redeemed. And mankind was ripped off. And so I am quite troubled with the movement of Morabito now into this area of the use of the electronic dinar. I don't have anything more to say on that. Now then, how do we respond? How much more time do I have? 6 minutes. At an individual level. Number one, the Prophet said, alayhi salatu wasalam, this hand is better than this. A Muslim, therefore, should do everything he can possibly do to try to avoid debt. A business debt is different from a personal debt. A business debt is something which sometimes cannot be avoided. But it is short term. It is short term. And it can instantaneously be liquidated if the requirement emerges. So this does not form part of the up and down of the hand. The other debt, which is the debt which cannot be instantly liquidated if the situation arises, that's the one we should avoid. That you ask for a loan, and if it is required of you to repay the loan, the next day you can't repay it. No. This hand is better than this hand. Avoid debt. And in the last chapter of this book, you'll have find us a whole section of ahadith dealing with debt. A debit card is different from a credit card. In a debit card, you're using your own money. Like an ATM card. In a credit card, you're using somebody else's money. The agreement for the credit card is that you must pay the money back by a certain time. And once you do that, fine, no problems. This is exactly how it operated in Mecca, and this is exactly how it operates today. I will give you this money, you can use it, and provided you repay it back to me by such and such a day, no problems. But if you do not repay me by that deadline day, then you'll have to pay a penalty, namely an increase in the amount of money to be returned to me, which today is called interest. That is exactly what the credit card does today. No difference between Mecca and the credit card. That was riba. The increase in the amount that you now have to repay the credit card company is easily recognizable now as riba. Well, what about if I sign the agreement, I take the money, but I pay back on time? Is that okay? I don't have the time to question you, otherwise I would do it. I sign an agreement to the effect that I'm borrowing this money from you and I must repay it by this deadline. And if I do not repay it by this deadline, I pledge to pay the interest. I had 200 Muslim students from the East Coast of the United States, from Boston all the way to Miami. I had them all in a hall in Philadelphia, and I was lecturing to them on the subject, the credit cards. So I said, do you mind? All those who have a credit card in your pocket, could you kindly raise your hands? The whole room raised their hands. Nearly everybody raised their hands. So then I said, okay, I'm sure you're paying back your money in time, so you don't have to pay riba. And they all started nodding their heads, of course, of course, of course. Now and then, of course, we fail, we got to pay the riba. Is this transaction halal or haram? The signing of that agreement. I asked them, suppose the credit card company had put into the agreement this condition, that if you don't pay back the money on time, you got to drink a glass of whiskey. Would you sign the agreement? The whole room became quiet. That was the finish, the end of the argument. No, we will never sign such an agreement. That we agree to drink a glass of whiskey if we don't pay back on time. And it is in the psychology of knowledge that sometimes you got to deliver a wake-up call to people. You got to shock them. So they'll always remember. That's burning the paper money. So then I asked them, I said, kindly excuse me, but I got one more question. If the credit card company put into the agreement that if you do not pay the money back on time, you would agree to commit zina with your neighbor's wife, would you sign the agreement? Now the silence was even more. I said, okay. The agreement to sign for riba is worse than the agreement to sign for the glass of whiskey. The agreement to sign for riba is worse than the agreement to sign for zina. The Prophet said, sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam, whosoever consumes even one dirham of riba, it is worse than if he committed zina 36 times. And so, the lesser of two evils is a debit card rather than a credit card. If you have savings, do not keep your savings in paper, but rather convert them into gold and silver. You've got Kruger Rands in this country. Finally, the micro response, which I consider to be the most productive, the most beneficial, the most comprehensive, the one most likely to benefit us and protect us the most, is the micro-response which the Murabitun had been pioneering. The establishment of a Muslim market, which is a micro-market, in which you will use the Sunnah money, and from which you will exclude both the commercial bank and the Islamic bank. I call this the Muslim village. And I do not have to present the subject to you today, because inshallah when I come back to Cape Town on the 26th of February, we'll be having two lectures, one on the 26th and the other on the 27th. On the 26th, we'll take up the subject of the Quranic method of curing alcoholism and drug addiction. And on the 27th, we'll take up the subject of the establishment of the Muslim village. And both the subjects are connected with each other. In the Muslim village, you'll have the micro-Muslim market. And in that market, at a micro level, you can eradicate riba to the maximum extent that it is possible to do so at a micro level. When we come back, inshallah, we'll have a session, the last session for question and answers.
Let's say shukran to Maulana Imran Hussain. So without further ado, we'll have break for Asr. So we'll make Salatul Jama'ah at the mosque for those who wish. Okay, shukran.